If there's nothing new under the sun, you know I'm going over. 'Cause there's nothing left to say. If they said it all here yesterday. If there's nothing new under the sun, I'm going over. 'Cause there's nothing left to do. If I ain't got a chance at something new. 'Cause maybe this is a test, a chance to prove I've got the stuff.
Welcome back to Invent It Again. I'm Matt.
And I'm Christian.
We're making a few changes around the show. One of the changes that we're making is that snaps are going to be split out for your a la carte pleasure. We've found that we do like to talk about this stuff, and sometimes we can get into it and take a bit of time exploring ideas and exploring these concepts and principles, and sort of doesn't leave a lot of time for a snap, and that it might be easier for you as listeners to be able to jump through our concepts and jump through snaps that interest you by splitting them off. So today we're just talking about innovation sort of as a pipeline. I find this to be really useful. When Christian first brought up this analogy, I really learned quite a lot from it, and we've spent a little bit of time refining it just now. And it all begins really with imagining that there's a mains pipe. We all get our water from the mains. It comes from some reservoir somewhere. Depending on where you live, it can be in different forms. But essentially, you've got a pipe flowing down the road. And this is our mains pipe. And through this pipe flow the resources that we all use. And economic fitness, how well you're doing, is essentially how much water you can use effectively. That is, how much you can get to your glass as you hold it under the tap. Now, of the water that's currently coming onto a property through the mains pipe, Christian, how many liters does it take of water to get 1 liter to the tap?
Yeah, so we're talking about our flow of innovation through our pipe. We've mentioned these statistics before, so we're just making an idea a liter. So we're saying that if we're putting 3,000 liters of water, which is quite a bit of water, into our property, 1 liter is coming out and doing us good. This is what's been measured in arrears by people doing work on things that have been invested in. So it's across everything. It's across every method of commercialization. It's across every single source of ideas from academics and people and businesses and joint ventures and these sorts of things. So it's a really good definition. We've got some other statistics that back this up. So it's a bit further down the pipe in terms of time, and people say it takes 300 patented ideas to get one out at the other end. So that's things that people have considered and taken time over and spent money on, and it's still only 1 in 300. So talking raw ideas, it's 1 in 3,000, and a lot of people turn the lens on the fact that we're producing all these great ideas and all this great research and outputs, but somehow our ability to turn them into economic outcomes, if you like, or productive outcomes, is still as bad as it ever was. And there's a degree of mystery involved in why that might be. I mean, we've got some pretty good understanding of why that's the case, but effectively that's the backdrop here. So we've got 3,000 in, 1 out.
The average person has no idea why. It's all a bit of a black box. The water's coming on the property. We're paying for that water coming on, but we're only getting the 1 liter out the tap for every 3,000 coming in. So now you're aware of this, listener. You are aware of this, and congratulations. It's not a comfortable thing to be aware of, but if you don't know it, then you'll go your whole life just being party to this waste and suffering as a result. So what does a clever person do when they discover this ratio of in to out? They're going to dig. They're going to dig and try to find where the problem is happening in this black box. And so, and I'd go to my connection to the main. Out by the street, we all have this little box. Maybe we don't even have to dig for it. And we have a look at that. And we're going to find a valve. And this valve represents the first decision that we make in this system as we let it onto our property, let this water flow through our patch. That decision is whether or not we're going to invest a minute or a dollar into something. And this valve is stuck in a position which takes it through a network, this black box of dramatically leaky pipes. Obviously, we're losing 2,999 liters to every one that comes up the tap.
Yeah, so it's a pretty obvious black box, leaky box that we're dealing with. So it's not something dripping away and we're losing a tiny fraction.
No.
This is the vast serious majority. This is 3,000 times, or close to 3,000 times what we're putting in is being lost somewhere.
So the good news is that what we found was a valve. We didn't just find a tee off the mains and going straight into the black box where we have no control. There is actually a valve sitting at this position, and it's got a label on it. We ask, what does this valve do? Well, let's look at its label. It's labeled the risk valve. And if you learn to be careful about how you operate this valve, you can get more water out the other end. We'll find that it's currently in a default position. We're going to look at the farthest position. It's the other position first, and it's, we'll call it the farthest right, or I guess clockwise position. It's got a label miser, and we you know, being curious about what it would be, what that will do to our result. When we turn it to miser, we notice that we have a tank that fills up, and we can think of this as savings. So if you're a miser, you bypass this black box system, all these pipes going into your house. You find that you get more usable water. You've got a tank of it that you can use. It's leaky. We've got inflation. We've got other factors, the time value of resource that go down over time. But this miser position results in a storage of water on our property. But that's not the position that we found it in. What position did we find it in, Christian?
Well, there's a major position, which is the other end of the scale, which is a default position, which is maybe how it came out of the factory or what we're told other people have it in. And we've labeled that the sucker position, which explains how little you're getting out of the other end. And this really represents the fear of missing out. You know, other people have done this, so we're going to do it. And we need to follow other people. We're not making informed decisions, but we're just following what else happened. And we think that if we don't go down that road, then we're going to miss out. And that somebody else will do better than us because we've missed out on going down that road. So this takes it through effectively a black box. We don't know what's inside it. We're told that this potential that comes out the other end is going to deliver us a massive amount of water, but we don't really have any understanding. We don't know how it works. We're relying on other people's pictures, other people's beliefs and hopes. Again, we come back to that hopium thing, that this is what we hope will be the outcome of the black box, but we don't really know. And what actually is happening in the black box? Well, if we're looking at the 3,000 to 1 ratio, 2,999 litres of water that are going in, going off somewhere.
Disappearing
from our property, never to be seen again.
Neither of these positions, the far left or the far right, the sucker or the miser position, is going to get us where we want to be. Inflation and stagnation result from this miser position, and obviously the sucker position is what caused us to dig in the first place. There was nothing coming out the tap, or practically nothing coming out the tap. We weren't seeing any of the benefits of all this innovation. So we ask, what is this position in between the two? It has a label as well, and it's labeled informed. And we learn that it's really up to us where this flows. It's sort of a setting that allows us to choose how to route the water. And the act of this, of choosing, is really investing. And now that we've seen how poorly a black box performs for us, you know, with all these leaks and unknown routes, we would be foolish to route our water down another such black box system. We really need to know. We now have a desire to know where our water is going. So it would be better to leave it in the miser position and just let it fill a tank. We might lose some, but we'd be in a better position to just wait for a change and hold on to what we've got than to just route it down another black box because someone tells us it's a good idea. The odds are against us when we route our water down one of these unknown channels.
You know, the analogy here is with the investor. If you're not informed and you're following somebody else, then you're always going to be putting it down a black box of some description, because it's not something that you fully understand and you're fully informed about. And so you may be doing a numbers game, spreading your bets, if you like. You're still betting at 3,000 to 1 or 300 to 1, depending where you sit in that position. But the reality is that you're still operating at those odds. You might be putting your bets, you might be picking winners, and we've talked about picking winners before, but you're still investing in the black box model that we've got here.
So you really should only use this informed position if you are going to have the discipline to be informed. I mean, that's why this position is labeled in that way. And this does have a cost, but this cost is far lower than the black box is already costing us. And it really puts us in control of our destiny. And as we've said before, you'll guess that we're kind of steering towards the black box as really working outside of your circle of competence. And we're talking about working within and expanding your circle of competence. And that's really the only place where you have any control over your destiny. So the moment you flick the valve into this position, this informed position, you're going to be pitched endlessly by those who want your water, because now you do have to decide where it's going to flow. And they'll put very compelling ads in your face. They'll use every trick in the book to stoke this FOMO that's going to make you want to give them your water, your precious resource. This is where you really have to have the discipline to not be swayed, the comfort of occasionally flicking your valve back to a miser position when there are no opportunities where the odds are in your favor, and just being comfortable not acting.
Yeah, I think that's really important. We talked about other analogies of sports where the tactic of the sport is to leave a ball, a delivery, whether it's baseball, Warren Buffett talks about baseball, or whether it's about cricket. You know, the long game is that you choose which things you leave. In investing, there is a cost in terms of being informed. There is a cost of leaving, but the cost of leaving is the cost of being informed. And that is what gives you your ability to make those decisions and change those odds from something that is 1 in 3,000 or 1 in 300 to something that is much, much more favourable to you as an investor. So the odds are in your favour as opposed to being heavily against you.
So why is sucker the default position? If individually and collectively it is wiser to be informed and to be picky so that we don't have these tremendous odds against us, why is sucker the default position of our installation, so to speak?
A couple of reasons. One is that people like being to be seen to pick winners. I have this gift. I can pick winners, and it's easier and cheaper for me to be uninformed or marginally informed or rely on the information of other people and the presenters who present it in a way that paints their idea or their investment in the best light. So that's one reason. The reason is that on top of that sort of psychological and personality-based approach to investment is that the people who are backing innovation and the people who are undertaking activity within the system and within the black box, so that could be those people doing R&D or the advisory companies and all those sorts of participants, benefit from that sucker position. So we have the people who are funding it and they're presenting this position that somehow the amount you spend or the pressure in our hydraulic system relates to successful outcomes at the other end. We know that that's 3,000 to 1, and by doubling the amount of pressure or doubling the amount of investment, if you like, we'll call it that, going in at the front end, that's all happening at the same odds, 3,000 to 1. So by saying that there's an economic outcome as a result of increased expenditure, and we have that 2% of GDP on R&D by 2027, that the system is measured on the input. They're not measured on the outcomes. So it's very straightforward to say, oh, we'll just double the input, and look, we're doing an amazing job because we've doubled our input, when in fact the outcomes are not changed. And that outcome not changing is reflected in people saying, oh, we're really, really good at doing the research side of things, but somehow, despite the fact we're pumping up the pressure on the system or pouring more money into the R&D and the like, we're still not getting the outcomes that we want. And again, it's coming back to that question we posed at the start of why is this happening? And a big part of that is because we're using the wrong metrics. And not only that, but the stimulus is wrong. So the stimulus is there to do something which is unproductive.
And worse, and this has just occurred to me, that the increase will correlate with some more successful businesses out the other end. But then we'll be comparing our performance against poor performance in the past rather than how good our performance could be if we were filtering and choosing things effectively.
Yes, that's right. Going back to some points we made in previous times, that there's a difference between investment and cost. So
yes,
when we're looking at investment, the reality is we're looking to make a return on the investment. That's why we put the money in, and that's why we invest in things. If we're investing at odds 3,000 or 300 to 1, the chances are that our returns on investment are going to be negative. We're going to be losing the money. And that's exactly what Michael Schrage talks about in terms of the vast majority of projects lose the money. And so that's why we need to be as frugal and as fast, cheap and easy to test these ideas, because otherwise we'll be forever losing money overall. And that's important to look at that. So we need to start looking at the activity of this and the inputs as costs, because at 300 to 1, they're going to, more likely, anything that goes in is going to be a cost. And for the majority of these things, 299 out of 300, they're going to be unrecoverable costs.
Right.
And so the participants in that black box, and the, I think we call them the installers of the system
pipe,
here,
the plumbers.
Pipe and the plumbers and and these things, are the ones who are financially benefiting from it, not from the investors that are putting the money in. So
taking this to the government, who is funding R&D without any quantification of the ROI. So this is actually one of the mechanisms that causes us, it's a very anti-democratic part of the system, which is that we're kept sort of dependent on and trusting of them without being able to learn from measuring the economic outcomes of R&D.
Yes.
Is that right? So can we know how effective it is at the moment with what is reported?
We can't, but equally go back to the fundamentals. The concept that spending more money is a measure of economic outcomes, or the only one, this is the only one they've got, is absurd.
And yes.
When you actually think about it, it's a ridiculous situation. We had 300 ideas that people have deemed worthy of patenting, which is the statistic we're talking about, the US Patent Office statistic. It's somewhere between 300 and 500 patents that only one becomes capable of recovering the cost of patenting. So just in a basic sense, I'm talking sort of school maths here, that if you double the amount of money you're putting into those things, you're still only going to get a success rate of 1 in 500 or 1 in 300. And this is no measure of economic return. It can't be any measure of economic return. It can only be the statistical chance that it recovers its costs.
Right, okay.
And so the thinking that if we spend twice as much money or we create activity, is going to make no difference at all.
Right.
It's absurd. I can't explain that.
A metric is a directive. It's a strategy. Yep. In terms of saying 2% GDP, when you're talking about how much to increase the inputs.
That metric or that objective of increasing the business expenditure on R&D, so again, it's business expenditure
only
on R&D,
yes.
To 2% of GDP by 2027. Now, one of the questions to ask, and I have asked it, is what happens when we reach this 2% expenditure? Is there going to be things falling out of the sky, or are there going to be fireworks over the Harbour Bridge in Auckland? What's actually going to happen?
Right.
What does it mean to get to that? Is that the summit of Everest and we've conquered something?
Right.
Or is it meaningless? What's the meaning? What can be derived from that achievement?
Yeah. Is it an end or is it a means? And if it's a means, to what end?
Yep.
So you're saying that they're only reporting on activity. The only thing that's being measured and reported on is activity. In other words, let's say that they invested in 3,000 businesses,
yes.
And one of them, or two of them, there was a commercial outcome. They made something, they profited from that, and then they paid tax on that, and that tax came back to the government. You'd have to have some measure of something like that in order to know what the return on the investment in the R&D was, right?
Again, we're using the word investment. So
okay.
We've got no measure of the...
Well, they're claiming that it's investment.
Yes.
We've already debunked that it isn't. But still,
right.
Just for Callaghan to be logical to its own charter and to its own goals and structure, they have to report on something. They're taking our money and doing stuff with it. Are we literally not at all examining what the commercial outcomes of that expenditure are? Flat, full stop, no. And that was meant in their charter, that the Auditor General was meant to be, or no, that's never even been put into the structure?
No, it's not. As far as I understand it, there's no measurable ROI that only measures, and these are from papers that have been published through the Productivity Commission and the like, that the measures are all around activity.
Yes, okay.
So whether that's R&D activity or whether it's patenting activity or whether it's conference activity, these are the measures that are made. And they're compared against a league table of other countries.
And we're doing...
And they've admitted that we're really good at doing the research and we're in the top 10 countries in the world, maybe number 7, I think, of quality of research, but our ability to commercialize isn't there. And so
as innovators, we're failing. Because if we're not exploiting it, then we're not innovating. Because you can't say you're good without both parts.
Completely right. And don't forget is that the focus is on R&D. And in the definition of innovation, there is no inclusion of R&D. So we are typically, and this is not solely New Zealand, and there's no criticism of New Zealand compared to the rest of the world, but we conflate expenditure on R&D with innovation. And the two are not the same, and they can't be compared. One doesn't lead to the other, and there is no relationship between how much you spend and how successfully you commercialize something.
So this is a red flag. just as we talk about looking at a startup and seeing red flags in their IMs, the kind of language that we should defend ourselves against, like world's first, you know, behold my invention, the likes of which the world has never seen. We should also be aghast when we see that there is this amount of money going to something with no measurable economic return.
Exactly.
So to get back to our analogy, you've got to unearth that valve. You've got to take it off the sucker position. And right now, as a nation, we feel that we're in sucker position. We are allowing this 3,000-to-1 odds to be bet on. And that's not sustainable. It may generate jobs. It does generate jobs. It pays experts. It pays researchers and developers to build things here in the country. And those guys pay taxes. And so there is the argument that it's keeping the economy going, but that's a bubble. Unless there's actual substance and actual innovation and new things, new knowledge and improvements happening, we will not remain competitive in the global economy, and we won't be able to maintain the quality of life that we enjoy.
And this comes back to the real emphasis across the board of that whole supply chain, if you like, or the whole innovation space. And this is a reality. Boston Consulting said this about 20 years ago, that the net present value of R&D is negative. So if you take all of the R&D projects and put them all together, mm-hmm. and you look at how much money goes in and how much money comes out in terms of people being productive and successful outcomes, then that number is negative. And that's not surprising given it's 1 in 300 or 1 in 500,
yeah.
because like we said before, that outcome is only a measure of something that recovers its costs.
Right.
It's not a multiple of, if you put a dollar in at the start, you don't get 500 out at the other end or 3,000.
No.
It's not a measure of that at all. It's a measure of a
all or nothing.
Of a successful product, which has come off the product launch and made money in the market. So it's the S-curve or the hockey stick or the J-curve.
Or the flat line in death.
Exactly. And there's no productivity in the flat line and death.
That's right.
And so unless we can improve those odds and make them favourable, then the productivity of this activity
is negative. So hopefully this has been a call to action and that this analogy has helped everyone visualise the problem and where the solution really is, which is, as we've said, is to go right back to the mains pipe and to get at that very first valve and to get active at the earliest point, the farthest upstream point that you can. And this really brings us to what we're trying to achieve here. And so today we want to share with you our open source charter. We invite comment on this charter. We will publish it on the website for all to see and for input from anyone who's interested. And essentially it is there for anyone involved at any level, from a ratepayer with no ideas of their own and who doesn't invest money other than paying rates, because if you're a ratepayer, you're investing in this nation, right up to the most experienced venture capitalists and researchers and scholars in our country. We want you to sign this charter and to live by it. And we do believe that by doing so, we will increase our collective chances at success. So I'll just read it out loud off the document, if that's okay. Just briefly to just prompt a bit of discussion and so that everyone understands what's behind each component of this charter. The background is that Team New Zealand is small, remote, and has ample but finite resources. We face numerous challenges as we transition towards an all-inclusive and sustainable economy. These include distance from other markets, our small population, economic inequality, high cost of living, and many more. In order to make this transition successfully, we need to be as efficient as possible in allocating resources for the creation of new products, commercial services, and social services. We already allocate our resources in the form of grants, tax rebates, vouchers, subsidies, volunteerism, mentorship, and private and public investment. But in order to ensure the efficient use of those resources, these new products and services must solve a real problem and must generate returns in the form of tax revenue, increased quality of life, savings, and profit. To achieve this, we must avoid wasting resources on research and development that has already been done. We must not reinvent the wheel. Instead, we must stand on the shoulders of giants by first learning all that can be known about each problem and how it has been solved before. By doing these things, we'll increase the effectiveness of our innovation and, as a result, increase our quality of life, the only metric that matters. And I think this is really important to remember. That is the only metric that matters on Earth. We can invent all manner of ways to measure things, but if it's not that, quality of life, if that's not what we're measuring, then it really should be considered a means to achieving that. The ideation process pledge. So in this section of the charter, we're going to switch to first-person language and get the signer to commit. So there's a clear, established, proven, and repeatable process for achieving our common goals. By signing this charter, you pledge to require this process be followed for each and every idea that is presented to you for investment. And I do want to draw everybody's attention back to what investment, our definition of an investment. It's not just about taking a dollar out of your pocket to hand to someone to develop an idea. You do it in the form of paying rates. You do it in the form of spending 1 minute of your life listening. Time is a limited resource as well. So you invest time when you entertain people bringing you ideas. The steps of this process are described as the four gates because each one is a potential end or pivot point for each idea processed. The remainder of this charter is written in the first person in order to emphasize a personal commitment to shared ideals. I pledge not to charge money for my professional services to a client without first checking that it has passed the four gates, unless it is to provide guidance and services to support progress through the gates. In such cases, I will endeavor to keep each step in the process as short and each iteration within each step as inexpensive and as fast as is practical. This is inspired by the fail fast, you know, motto. It's really that simple.
Gate one, I will identify a real problem and assess its value. So I will clearly describe a real problem. I will represent its value according to the returns generated by solving it. If the returns cannot be described, then I will not proceed further. I will either clarify it or find another to work on. If the return can be described, then I will describe my method for determining this value, generally as a function of the number of people who experienced the problem multiplied by what they would pay to solve it. This doesn't have to be detailed at this phase. I'm doing napkin estimates. So this is not a thesis. It's a clear and concise determination of the problem and the value of solving it.
I'll take gate two, which is I will identify other solutions. I will thoroughly search the global stock of knowledge for ways in which this problem has been solved before. This is really the crux of it. I will perform this search with the assumption that my idea is not new. I'll be happy to find evidence of this fact and will be entirely transparent of what I find, omitting nothing in my report. So the global stock of knowledge comprises patents, articles, videos, books, films, reports, and other forms of recorded knowledge. It is not enough to only look for existing competitors with products and services currently in the market. It's also not enough to search only in English, nor for search terms that are overly wide or overly narrow. This process requires curiosity, humility, and discipline.
Gate three, I will describe the idea, the solution to the problem, and assess its cost. I will provide a clear, detailed, and cost-effective solution to the problem. I could use a laser to open a walnut, for example, but it would not pass the cost-effective test. I'll recommend the best solution, even if it is not the one that inspired the undertaking of this process.
And this is also a really important pivotal point, isn't it? That we mustn't go in with just our own preconceived notions. We really have to be dedicated to the problem and solving it.
And this is exactly what you talked about, humility matters, understanding that though the idea came from within yourself as an individual, that it may not stack up against ideas that have come from other individuals or from the past as well.
And we will read out the principles as well, because this is an important component of this. But just getting on to gate four, I will honestly represent the opportunity to myself and others. I recognize that passing an idea through the previous gates will give me the clearest possible picture of the opportunity at this early stage. If I rushed, cut short, or ignored anything passing through a previous gate. I am harming myself by creating a fantasy, wasting my own time and money. If I omit, exaggerate, or otherwise misrepresent my findings when presenting this opportunity to others, I am doing even worse. I am intentionally deceiving others, which is a crime. Having read this charter, I have no excuse for engaging in such behavior.
A point to mention there, Matt, is that it is seen as a strategy for people to push their idea without doing any rigorous analysis, to offload the responsibility of doing the analysis onto a patent examiner. And that's something which causes a lot of trouble, because again, that's one of those signals that the investor looks at, and the fact that it's been passed on to an examiner and the examiner has come back with an okay response
because they're overworked
and underpaid and don't have time to do a really thorough job, that the investor looks at the fact that a patent's been applied for sometimes, and also
or even granted.
Patent been granted as well, is a signal that things are okay. So people are relying on the weaknesses in the system to push their idea to the front of the viewing platform.
Tiny bubbles that grow into bigger bubbles and then collectively grow into economic bubbles that burst and bring down countries. I recognize that I'm part of a team that shares common goals and limited resources, and as such, I cannot in good conscience develop solutions to a problem without knowing as much as can be known about how the problem has been solved by others before me. I accept that there is a direct inverse relationship between the number of raw ideas tested and the cost of failure. Can you unpack just that one for us, Christian?
Yeah, so again, this is saying that if we test ideas, if we only tested one idea and it passed our test in the first instance, then we've got all our eggs in one basket, effectively. And so the more ideas that we test, the more frugal and the more practiced and a better result we'll have from the test process. And what that means is the cost of failure, if you like, or the cost of an informed decision becomes less and less as time goes on. So
perhaps failure actually would be better represented by, we talk about pivoting and leapfrogging and changes in direction. So would it be a better way to put this? And this is part of the process. We're reading this out loud and testing it ourselves. I accept that there's a direct inverse relationship between the number of raw ideas tested and the cost of being informed.
Yes, the cost of being informed. Being well practiced at being informed means that you can take the informed decision point back to the earliest possible time frame. So the cost of being informed for each idea tested as time goes on and with more ideas is going to be less and less,
right?
Because the point at which you're able to make an informed decision
is earlier. Great. I will not substitute volume for quality. I'll recognize that metrics that rate my performance based on anything other than the cost of failure is a symptom of unethical behavior. I'll do everything in my power to patiently, constructively, and peacefully effect change in any organization that exhibits such behavior. And this is something that we're trying to do right now and asking for support to do. We really want the best for the country and for the best results from our innovation. And we can't always just leave it up to others to know how to do this.
And if you like as well, we've already talked about it, is the metrics that Rate performs at the moment is how much you spend. So if we're striving or we're being advised or stimulated to spend more, then the cost of failure is going to be more. To justify the metric, we're going to be spending longer and more time and money and more resource on something when we should be trying to spend less.
And when our guiding metric is quality of life, increased cost of failure directly impacts our quality of life, because we could be spending it on
spending more is incompatible with frugal innovation, doing things quick, easy, and cheaply.
Well summed. Last little addendum here, at least in this current form. Although we wish it would go without saying and should be implied by the requirement to solve a real problem, we explicitly require that there be scientific evidence of both the existence of the problem and of its ability to be solved. For example, we must not invest in a product or service that protects you from damage resulting from exposure to Wi-Fi, as there is no scientific evidence that Wi-Fi is harmful to humans, nor one that allows you to speak with the dead. Bit of a cheeky example, but it really illustrates that it is able to be solved. We already have laws about health claims and marketing, but it is better to stop such projects before they've created victims who then have to appeal to the legal apparatus. And that's the charter as it stands right now. And obviously, I believe it'll morph a bit. It'll develop a bit before we really get any reasonable uptake. But I'm committed to the principles of this charter. You can take this as me signing up to it, although I will do it physically when we've finalized the wording. And I honestly believe and have experienced that these are the things that we need to commit to in order to have better results.
I'd just add one point in there. And we can
let's do it now. You can do things on the fly. That's how we roll.
Think from on a personal level, and I'm talking about individuals here, that it has to be recognised that the responsibility for the individual to develop their circle of competence around any particular idea or not, whether it's by reading or otherwise, is their responsibility.
I recognize that I am responsible for expanding my own circle of competence. Now, this is going to make teachers really happy. You know, we do have an educational component to all this. We're trying to educate people. And I'm just having this conversation about one of my kids. It's a really important one that every parent has to have, which is at some point you have to help your child to understand that they are the CEO of their own life. They're the CEO of their own education. You know, they're the principal teacher. All the teachers work for them. If they don't have the desire and take responsibility for their own learning, you could have all the greatest teachers on earth and they'll never get them anywhere because they don't take ownership of that.
That's right. And this is all related again to the hopium. And one of the principles which we've talked about in terms of the way that we work is turning things on its head slightly. And it's not a total flip, but when we're approaching these things, we have to, when we're looking for things and we're searching for things and constructing this information in our circle of competence, we need to be able to define what isn't new. We're going to call that what isn't new. It's not novel about a particular idea. And in doing that, it's a much more robust process than making an assumption that something is new and then finding a few things that are like it and creating the view that we're being supported and we're being, I always use the term, being a sycophant, but people are saying this is yes, we think your idea is new and providing opinions. If you can provide definitive evidence that aspects or all of the idea isn't new, that's where we need to start from. That's at the point at which we have our circle of competence.
You've said in the past that the only way to 100% establish freedom to operate is by proving that everything you've said is not new. And that's kind of a corollary to what you've just said now.
It is.
It's the one way that you can have utter confidence to proceed. So it's not something to fear, right? It's actually something to celebrate.
That's completely right. And that also gives you a view on other people's potentially imaginary positions, because you know where they sit along that chronology or the line of thinking and the circle of competence.
I do want to get in today about, because we really haven't talked about the structure of this knowledge, like what comes out of the process, which if anybody's been listening along, you're probably hanging to hear how we actually structure this and what the product is. But before we do that, I just want to just quickly read down the principles, because we keep coming back to them. And we just mentioned one here, and I will start almost backwards. We just said celebrating. Which one is this? Get excited when you discover that your idea has been expressed before. It means that not only were you as insightful as those bright sparks that came before you, but also that you can stand on their shoulders and reach higher more quickly than you could from scratch. It's also the only way to establish undeniable freedom to operate. So there you go. So let's just quickly whack through these principles, which I don't believe I have them on the website yet. By the time you've heard this, I will. While we're asking everyone to sign up to this charter if they want to be participating in this democratization of ideas and innovation, but these principles are a little bit more specific about what you need in order to be a good looker, i.e. someone who is expanding their circle of competence in order to improve outcomes. The first one is to be as curious as a child. We're all born as a fountain of questions, but we often learn to stop asking them, sometimes because we feel that growing up means we're supposed to be providing the answers. I certainly fall into this trap. Don't rely on your gut alone. We are wired to trust our gut feel. It's an extension of our survival instinct, but only facts matter. Your idea will almost always feel new, but this is almost certainly a result of what you don't know. It is overwhelmingly unlikely that any idea has not been thought of and recorded before, at least in part. Further to this, if you shouldn't rely on your own gut, you shouldn't rely on someone else's gut either. Be grateful for the wealth of knowledge we've inherited. Realize and exploit the value of the enormous and detailed record of human accomplishments that we call the global stock of knowledge, which includes those patents, articles, papers, books, videos, and more that we've talked about so many times. I've already said the getting excited bit about finding your idea hasn't been expressed before. Don't fear running out of ideas. Kind of come back to our hydraulic pressure one. There will always be pressure in the mains pipe. There will always be problems that humans face. And for each new problem, there will always be new ways of solving it. We'll never run out of problems, so we'll never run out of ideas to solve them. Be honest with yourself and others. This is directly in the charter, because although we wish it would go without saying, we witness behavior that doesn't adhere to this, and that's wrong. When we have an idea, it's so easy to see it as a part of who we are. We could call this identifying with your idea, basing your identity in your idea. And this can really cause us to ignore the facts, and it can do that subconsciously, which is really dangerous. We delude ourselves, and we're not even aware of it. Good ideas can come from anywhere, including from you. Who we are doesn't matter. It's all about the process, the process, the process. But this doesn't mean that we don't value those who haven't made a novel contribution yet. We should practice and encourage the startup process, even when the core idea is not new. But we must consider that education, not innovation. So when we do events, when we do education around this stuff, we either get them onto real new ideas that we've identified through this rigorous process, or if it's not, that's cool, but it's practice. It's just practice building a business and going through those motions, which can be valuable.
And equally defining your circle of competence or the global stock of knowledge, if you like, for a specific idea is education. These are things that already exist.
Right.
And so finding them and structuring them is educating yourself as to what already exists. And so that's
taking the D out of research and development, right? We're talking about research.
That's right.
Which is really an educational undertaking, an academic undertaking.
Completely. And the other thing you've got to remember from an investment perspective and actually from a research perspective, if things are truly new, and a lot of the times they're not, and we've got those big statistics around duplication of R&D and everything else, if something that you believe is new, whether you're the researcher or the developer or the founder or the innovator or the investor, from either of your perspectives, then you are operating in terms of what you think is new is outside your circle of competence, because from your perspective it doesn't exist. And so that's a really important basis on which to define your circle of competence based on what does exist in the global stock of knowledge, so that your novelty is as narrow and defined as it possibly can be.
Until you said that last sentence, I was going to say a good way of thinking about this is that it's about that claim that this is entirely new.
Yep.
Right, never before. Behold my invention, the likes of which the world has never seen. Yep. We're not saying that people who have actually really done their homework aren't likely to come up with something new. You can and you will if you're working at the cutting edge where you should be.
That is right. But, and I think we've mentioned this before, in terms of putting that information together, whether it's for yourself and understanding what you need to do strategically from any perspective, so it could be legal, investment and R&D, a whole heap of other things, you need to understand, you need to create a story that says, once upon a time,
yes, yep,
this person thought of something.
Yep.
Then you need to say, this is what this person did slightly later on, this is a development they made, and this is where this thing's going in terms of the development pathway and the timeline and the decision tree. And you get to a point of saying, this is what everyone else has done. And in some cases, it's all been done. And that's not a bad thing. It's a really good thing.
Yeah.
In some cases, you might say, well, actually, they've done 98% of what I want to do. Then you can say, and it gives you an opportunity to say, this is my part of the story. This is my novelty. This is my special sauce. These are the limitations of what everyone else has done.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the earliest thing, and this is what I'm doing, which overcomes those limitations. So you're defining the problem and you're defining your solution as being an improvement over what everybody else has done.
This was the motto of my company, Limitless Resources: know your limitations and overcome them.
Yep.
Cool. Ties in. Now, let's come back to the story.
Yes.
The word story, as soon as we finish the principles. We only have three more. Be frugal. There's lots of ways of expressing this. Fail fast, use lean methodologies, iterate, pivot, leapfrog. But under all of them is the simple trait of appreciating that resources are precious, that your time on earth especially is precious, and we should spend as little as possible on each idea before committing to them. Unfortunately, this is exactly the opposite message sent by the government's drive to increase R&D spending to 2% GDP.
I think something to add there, and that is that a lot of people talk about fast failure, but they don't provide the mechanisms or the objective basis for doing it. So again, you might have a group of ideas and you might go and put it in front of a panel of people that are all using their own stock of knowledge as a proxy for the global stock of knowledge, their own circle of competences, and you're not getting a good mechanism for why you should not do something or why you should do it. So
right. So it's failing fast is not enough. You have to fail it fast for the right reasons.
And be informed right. about why you're failing it and, right. and be objective about why you're putting one thing in front of the other, not just...
That's something I don't think we've actually discussed that before, and that's really important. We should probably come back to that. Yeah. Let me just to reiterate. Again, fail fast.
Otherwise it's picking winners.
Right, and losers.
Yeah.
Fail fast doesn't just mean to fail something fast. It means to fail something fast for the right reasons. Let's come back to that as well. Yeah. Don't mistake an idea for a business. We were talking about this a little bit in the last episode and also today, that ideas themselves are not investable. If you really understand the odds, you will see that R&D is a cost, not an investment. And finally, be content with exploiting existing ideas. And this does kind of re-express getting excited about something being expressed before or done before, but it bears repeating in a different way. Stop obsessing about what is new and what isn't. Let your love for your fellow humans and all the other creatures of the earth and your desire to solve their problems be your motivation instead of letting your ego trap you in its desire to be first. You are important and unique regardless of your timing. Get out there and solve problems and you will create yourself a life worth living. So those are our principles and we're sticking by them. But I did interrupt Christian when he just applied the word story, the once upon a time notion, which he also alluded to when we did a snap previously and taught me that one of the first things you do when you go to the patent results is to sort them by oldest, because that is where you'll find the clearest, broadest definition of the problem and the proposed solution at that time. Because obviously over time, when it goes well, that gets refined and refined and you get a narrower and narrower picture of some aspect of the problem and how to improve on it. I'm just going to set Christian up to talk just briefly about the newest iteration of something that you've been doing for decades and which you have many international customers, repeat customers who come back to you because you're very good at this, which is to give us a competitive landscape snapshot. Will you just talk to us a little bit about why you begin at the beginning, so to speak? But also, I want to tie that to a game that I know you haven't played, but you might have seen something like this. We might have talked about this before, where there's a game called Civilization by Sid Meier that has a tech tree. And when you're building your civilization, you start at a certain point in history, you invest turns in researching various things, which unlock various other things. So it's a decision tree of how you decide to develop your technology. So can you just talk about that analogy, about that way of visualizing about this competitive landscape and why the chronology comes from the earliest point and includes everything else that's been done to refine it and how we outline the limitations and again, how we've overcome them and why this has such value, why this is so critical to all of this.
No problem. So we've called it a story today. I typically call it a chronology. So this is a sequence of things that happen over time. And we've talked about saying that this is what everyone else has done up to the present point and these improvements that they've made. And the key feature of research and the key feature of intellectual property and invention is novelty. And we know we keep talking about novelty and it doesn't matter if something's novel or not. What's important actually is whether you know it's new or not. Because to legitimately patent something, And this is kind of any registrable IP in terms of designs and patents, you need to be the first. And it's almost an absurd position to be in. We talked about absurdity over other things earlier, but this is, you've got to be able to say, hand on heart, that what my invention is something that has never been disclosed before anywhere in the world,
in any point language. In time,
any language, any format. Could be a picture, it could be a document, newspaper article, could be
cave painting,
it could be a YouTube, exactly, it could be a cave painting, it could be a YouTube video, all manner of things, parchment, you name it. So long as it's been disclosed and somebody can associate a date or a period of time with it, then that comes there. And what's really interesting from the patent perspective is that, and it's something that's really important, and this is where patents are very beneficial from the perspective of telling a story, is that they record who the inventor was, what the idea was. More modern ones have information about what they've compared it to when they've made their assumption or made the declaration of that novelty. Mm-hmm. It's got all of those things. But the other thing that's really important is, and we've talked about it before, is that a patent needs to be applied for. These are documents that are put forward. In the old days, they used to put models with a lot of patents. You know, so you can go onto eBay and look for patent models, and you find all sorts of interesting things. But they had to disclose it in the patent before it was disclosed publicly. And so you can't patent something that somebody's already disclosed. And so what's contained in the patent information is all the things, the ideas that people had that didn't work, that didn't go forward, the failures, if you like. And in most other publications, things are only really mentioned when they failed in the market. So you might have something like a jetpack or something like that. We know that people spent a lot of money. We know that it was disclosed publicly, and there was also a patent associated with it. And it became a well-known failure because it had failed after.
Mm.
It had been...
It was visible already.
...widely known and talked about and invested in and everything else. So the great thing about the patent database is that, and information associated with that, and quite often with popular mechanics as well and popular science and those sorts of things, they typically have, oh, this guy's come up with this new idea for something, you know, and done things before with fishing torpedoes and all these sorts of things, and then somebody's created out of their shed, and it becomes
some fishing torpedo. Oh, there's to let them
the long lines out.
Yeah, off the beach, yep. You can just send your little
I've been doing this submarine for 100 years. So all sorts of different things. And,
batteries seems to be the hotbed right now. So every other one is about batteries, battery technology.
That's right, and so you can look at all of those things over time. So this is where the story comes in. So you're finding some sort of structure to this information from the patent database, and equally you can find structure from the other literature database, so the newspapers and the, well, I think I've shown you those British Pathé newsreel videos of all sorts of crazy things. YouTube, of course, there's lots of videos on there, and other platforms too. So all of a sudden you start to knit these bits of information together, and this is what we're talking about when we're trying to populate this information and everything else. So you might take somebody's name or a company from one silo of information and find out that they worked for somebody else, and this is what they did when they worked for somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's lots of connections, but equally there's quite a lot of jumps. So it's not like a genealogy story where you're trying to find the parent of the parent of the parent.
Right.
Quite often there's no connection in time, and people do go through tranches. For example, the energy crisis in the 1970s, you'll find that there's an awful lot of things that people did then, which people have kind of repeated in the last few years because they're looking at alternative energy and fuel drop-ins and this sort of thing. And there was a period before then where people were looking at doing things slightly differently. And then in different countries, you had the war, the Second World War, and people were trying to make fuel out of oil in the ground, but biomass and gasifying things and all these sorts of things. So it's about stitching that together. But the fundamental thing is novelty, which means that you can't legitimately patent something that somebody's done before. So novelty, if you like, is cumulative.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you look hard enough when you're doing this, you generate lots and lots of information, and you think, what does it all mean? There's this soup of data points that we don't really know. And the way that you knit those together is in the chronology. So you put them in date order, and you find the very earliest thing you can.
Once upon a time. The genesis.
Yeah. This is some person back in generally the 1800s, even for some software things, I can give you examples of that, started way back, and it was a very simple claim: this is what I want to do. And just an example, the software was somebody looking at an app that you could effectively put a nurse bell call system on, so you could say
if you're a patient in a hospital,
I want a glass of water, or I want help with this, or it's an emergency, you press thing rather than just pressing a bell and having the wrong person coming and running and doing those sorts of things.
So now most of us would go, we don't need to look earlier than 1970 because, you know, computers weren't around, you know, really we could probably look after 2000 when the internet became a bit more ubiquitous.
That's right. but in terms of, and you'd be right in terms of how you manage that data and how you analyze it and those sorts of things.
But
the earliest patent we found was from the 1860s, and it was created by a guy who was a pioneer of the telegraph industry. And what he'd done is he transferred his telegraph, so wired system, to a hotel. But like in those old country houses, you have a bell for each room. And what he'd done is, rather than just having a bell for each room, which is what the hospital bed is, an addressable bell, that he'd incorporated a switch with multiple positions of the switch around a dial, if you like. So what you did was you turned the dial to what it was that you wanted, and which in this case one of them was, you know, come make the fire, or I want a brandy.
Brandy.
And you turn it to whatever you wanted, and then press the bell, and lo and behold, downstairs through the wires, the reception would know that room 9 wanted a brandy.
Yeah.
And so it's still really relevant in terms of what you're trying to achieve and what you're trying to avoid. The problem you're trying to solve is somebody running up there and then finding out what it is and having to go away and sort it out. It was solved through technology that was available in the 1800s.
Right.
So the process really is to build, once you've got this soup of information, and it does get pretty big, and that's where it becomes quite unwieldy and people become reticent and they don't, you know, keeping lots of things open and lots of information together. But it's building up those things over time. The earlier you go, then the simpler it becomes, because it's the broadest thing. So I'm doing this wired call bell system.
Yep.
Anything that happens after that has to be new compared to that.
To that. Otherwise, I can ignore it. And there is noise. There's a tremendous amount of duplication in the record. I think this is an important thing to dispel everyone of thinking, you know, to not make the mistake of thinking that this is a monolithic, well-structured, you know, lacking duplication. Every patent that you pull up is perfectly structured. It's not that way at all. There are lots of duplicate claims and granted patents throughout the record.
Completely. And that's
highly imperfect.
And that's another important thing to come back when we do talk about the global stock of knowledge. But when we talk about research, we talk about things being new and adding new knowledge to that global stock of knowledge. The issue is that we know there's lots of duplication, and the duplication is adding to the global stock of knowledge, but we still need to take out the duplication that's in the global stock of knowledge and put it to one side. And that's taking all the noise out of that.
Right.
And so we can see exactly what we've gotten. So it's about stitching those things together. So you say, this is what this person did in 1800. And then lo and behold, somebody in 1890 did this. And you know, 1910, 20, 30, all the way through to the present day. And associated with that, there might be products. There might be, there might have been a product that was around in the 1920s that nobody is aware of these days. And so you will see that people took decisions. And I think in one of the previous episodes, we talked about the decisions that people have taken. This comes back to your tech tree thing, Matt. We talked about electric cars the corn oil and all this sort of thing. And we talked about the national cash registers and their failure to make changes in line with technological change. And so these are all decisions that people took at a particular point in time. And when you look back at this chronology, and it's not a complicated story, it's generally 10, 20 disclosures. And that, like I say, they can be from all over the place. It's not just patents. They can be papers and YouTube videos and all sorts of historical pharma sharing websites and all this sort of thing. That all fits together really, really well. So you end up with this chronology, you end up with a story, and you say, this is what these people have done over time. And coming back to what we said before, if we find that everything that we want to do has already been done, then that's great, because that gives you freedom to operate. You can go out and you can start making money tomorrow. You don't have to go, it would be ridiculous to go through and reinvent and reissue R&D that's already been done. So you're avoiding that duplication. So your resource consumption and time to market is much reduced. The only issue which this raises, and it's a really important issue as well, is ensuring that the inventor or the founder or the person doing the business knows why, if somebody did something in the 1970s or took that decision in the early 1900s with regard to electric vehicles and the like, why you making that same decision or reissuing that a similar product or solution now, why is it going to work for you when it didn't work for them? And there are lots and lots of different reasons for that. And generally, it's not the fact that it didn't work. I mean, people are obsessed with, it's my invention and it works. It does.
There's lots of patents and
we can talk about
the same story.
A lot of experience in alternative fuels and things. We can talk about, you know, making a fuel from algae that you can turn into a jet fuel. It's all technically feasible.
Yeah.
But in order to scale it and make it an economic prospect, it's just about impossible. Because you've got to grow this algae, you've got to harvest it, and you've got to take all the water out, you've got to turn it into oil, and all these sorts of things.
Yeah.
And by the time you get to turning it into a litre of jet fuel, which is worth not very much, then you could have gone down an alternate path where you've made spirulina or something like that, an algae, and you've sold it for $50 a kilo or something.
And that's only a failure. That particular failure is one whereby it's not an efficient process. It's possible, but there's another type of failure, which when you talked about cars, other factors, geopolitical factors, who had the money at the time? It wasn't the people who were tinkering with batteries and electric motors. There was a vested interest and big profits coming from people pulling oil out of the ground, and they lobbied and caused those other competitors to not be competitive. So those factors, in the case of a car, they have changed now. There is a pull away from that non-renewable energy, and so electric cars are viable.
And I think where the two correlate really well with that as well, Matt, is yes, it's about money, but it's also about who can scale and who can capture the market the quickest.
Right.
And so it might not be the best solution, and
but it's the quickest to market.
The Betamax and the VHS and the Video 2000.
Yeah.
It's all about the dynamics of who's there and can be prepared to dominate the market the quickest. Because if all of a sudden you become super efficient, again back to the S curves,
yes,
then you'll leave people who are less efficient, even if then you know they're
more effective,
a better solution, more effective. The implementation, if you're able to exploit much more quickly or commercialize much more quickly than somebody who's postulating and scratching their chins about whether they can get in the market or not, then they're the ones that are going to dominate. And that's not a technical reason why they succeeded. It's other forces, whether it's money or business models or a whole lot of other things as well.
So now you're already getting into sort of the outcome of the process, getting back to the process itself. And you left it right at the point where you were talking about the freedom to operate. If you've seen that everything that you have claimed is already there, then that establishes freedom to operate. I just want to reiterate for those for whom it's not self-evident yet that means that you're not going to get sued, or if you do, you have a defensive shield. You've got rocks in your pocket that can break the scissors. If you go back to one of our earlier episodes about the analogy where a patent is like a pair of scissors, but the prior art applicable pieces, the collection of these rocks in the form of a story, will defend you against them coming after you, and therefore you're protected. You have the freedom to operate without being sued, essentially.
That's exactly right, Matt. So you can't, as we said before, you can't legitimately patent something if it's been disclosed before. And
well, you can't. Unfortunately, you can, but that's only due to imperfections in the system.
That's right.
You're not supposed to be able to.
That's right. So the physical nature of getting a patent granted is still possible because people have missed the things in the prior.
Which is important.
Now, the very important thing here in terms of coming back to the lookers and how you do this is obviously finding the oldest things really important. So patents expire automatically after 20 years. So you can't infringe anything that's not current. So if you can show it's been done a long time ago, it's expired things, or even if it's non-patented as well, if it's been done a significant time before, then somebody can't come along and subsequently patent something that's been done before.
Yeah.
But of course there are lots and lots of gaps in this sort of perfection of the citation system and the way that things are done. We've talked a lot about people relying on the patent office to do the search work for them. And the point of the story actually is that if something is patentable, not only do you have a defensive position, somebody comes along and says, you're doing what we do, and you can say, well, I'm doing this thing from 1920 or 1880. That's a really good defensive position. So that's using the rocks as well. But if you truly have something novel, and it does happen, and I work with plenty of companies who do new things and have patents, is that you can provide your story to the examiner. And so in doing that, you can say, this is what everyone else has done. This person did this back in the 1800s and 1920 and all the way through. And you can show really robustly, because you've got such a good structure for your story, why what you're doing is new and what that is. And in effect, you're doing the work of the examiner for them.
Yep.
You're not asking them to affirm that it's novel. You're saying, this is why it's novel, and this is my fully informed case as to why my novelty is there.
And in as much as they're good at their job at all, you might also increase the chance that they will find something you didn't find, because you've given them so much more to go on. Yep. Now they're kind of, you know, standing on your shoulders and going and doing the next iteration, and something might occur to them and some search term might occur to them that increases your chances of avoiding a catastrophe.
And typically the examiner has their own, again, their own stock of knowledge, their own experience. And so if you're plucking something out of, and quite often a lot of these older patents have not been cited by anybody, they're these orphan bits of information. And so if you're producing an orphan piece of information and you're putting it in front of the examiner and you're including it in your story, you're increasing their stock of knowledge about what has gone on before. And that can be really useful if you're trying to highlight things that your competitors are doing and why they're not so good, and or what they've been done before. Then you can introduce a really old piece of prior art, a bit like a spring-free trampoline thing. You can say, well, this hasn't been cited by anybody, and this kind of is quite important even now, because it's a disclosure that's a long time ago. It's part of that whole story of where that's come from. So
free rocks. Collecting them is a good idea.
The thing with the story, Matt, as well, is that you can share that with other people. And it's very easy for people to see. If you've got a story with 10 or 12 items in it, and it's clear how the processes or the disclosures have been made over time, it's clear what the story is. It's equally clear to anybody else, including the examiner, but it could be an investor or somebody else. You're saying, I've done a thorough job here, and these are the things that I've found that relate to what I do, and these are the things that are not new about what I'm doing. And it's then clear that you've gone through a process, you're giving them definitive information, you're not making this stuff up.
Right.
That can then be used by those people, and that, in effect, fulfills their circle of competence. So if you're saying, this is my circle of competence, and I've done a really thorough job here, and I've understood what isn't new about what I'm doing, what is new about it, then I can communicate that to other people in a very, very simple way.
And as an investor of my own time and my own money, I want to see the story of the idea. I don't want to see the story of the team. And I think we'll never stop talking about how we use various things as proxies or substitutes or indicators of whether the opportunity is good or not. The only thing that matters is the facts, the story of the idea. So this does establish trust, and I won't turn the valve without it. I won't open the valve to that idea without that story.
Right. And, it's not subject to spin or
opinion
or any opinion or anything else. So
just the facts, ma'am.
Just the facts.
We've covered a fair amount of ground, but I think this was good to get back to the core tenets of what we're trying to do, the motivation in the charter, the means in terms of the principles, the way that we have to do what we have to do, and the output in terms of a story. And I hope that really is helpful to people listening to understand what it is that we're all about here. So everybody, I'm asking you to get fired up. Your money is being wasted. We are spending our rates dollars in an inefficient way, and that is not sustainable. If we want to remain competitive and we want to maintain a quality of life, we must stop that and we must work smarter. I'd like you to read the charter and give us your feedback, or if you don't have any feedback, go ahead and sign it and share it. We've got to make this a shared mission for us to achieve these goals. And again, post your idea or just a problem at inventitagain.com. And this is just a reminder that even if you haven't got an idea, we do want to hear about the problems that you face. There's a lot of value in just identifying good problems. There may be some solutions that have already been thought of that aren't apparent just because of some different market conditions of the past that caused something not to succeed. It might succeed now. And we've talked about a couple of examples with that. So please, you don't have to have a fully fledged idea. You can also come and just share a problem. And as always, please come back and listen again for the next episode. I want to thank Christian for his time.
Thanks, Matt.
And we'll see you next time on Invented Again.